So Dana's amazing. Okay, so now we are online, and I'm looking out of the mountains. What are you looking at, Colleen?
Pretty much mountains.
So Western Mountains meets Eastern Mountains. This is Colleen. I'm Richard Wirth, and I'm currently involved in the Masters of Entrepreneurship program at Western Carolina University, and I'm conducting a series of interviews with entrepreneurs. And I'd like to introduce Colleen Kubecko, who is an amazing entrepreneur and entrepreneur, a very unusual combination. And I actually independently met Colleen. We didn't know each other, but we were working with each other when Colleen worked out of Cincinnati for Fifth Third Bank. And one of her clients was my cookie manufacturer, Consolidated Biscuit. So she was looking at my receivable all the time, which probably got up to $5 million at one point. So we didn't know each other, but we were watching each other. Well, I was watching her, she was watching me. And then when Colleen came down to to head up Fifth Third as president of Fifth Third in Southwest Florida, which was a pretty undeveloped area when she came down, not like the East Coast. And we met down there, and I don't remember how we met, but what I'd like to do is have, instead of me talking about Colleen, I'd like to have Colleen talk about herself. The one thing I will tell you is that in this marketplace, I don't believe, even at maturity, there was much more than 350,000 people from Naples to Sarasota. Was there, Colleen?
Yes. About when I first came down, which was in 1992, Naples, or Collier County, had a population of about 150,000, and that was doubled in Lee County. So the total area was, you know, about 600,000 people. But you got to remember, many of those are seasonal.
Right. So, I mean, in reality, full-time, it was about 350 and seasonal, in that 600 figure. Tell us about your professional and personal past, to let people know what you've done and what you focused on, et cetera.
Thanks, Richard. And since I won't go through my almost 40 years of banking, I'll make it very quick. I got into banking when I was 16. My dad was a banker, actually, with a finance company. And actually, once you get it in your blood, you just don't leave the industry. And I didn't. I was also going to school at the time, and working full-time in a bank. I worked, my husband was transferred in 1980 to Cincinnati, Ohio, went into banking there. It was a very tough time for those who remember the 1980s. You know, that's when interest rates were double digit, got up to around 20% for the prime. And through that time, I did go back into banking up there. It was very unique, but not as difficult as it has been over the last 4 years. I worked my way up there through an organization to a vice president of the whole region in Cincinnati. And then I was given the opportunity to talk to Fifth Third Bank, which at that time was only about $7 billion. They are now well over $100 billion. But at $7 billion, I went with them in 1987.
What was the What was the organization that you ran the area for, the Cincinnati? What was the company?
That was called Cincinnati Savings. It was an SNL, and I had a very strong background in the mortgage side.
Okay.
So the SNLs at that time, they were the ones you thought of when you wanted a mortgage. You usually went to a savings and loan or a mutual bank at that time versus a regular commercial bank. Truly, there was a line divided between a Home Loan Bank, which, you know, Third Federal and some of those in the community, and the SNLs did the mortgage piece, and then the commercial stayed in the commercial realm of business. So when I came to Fifth Third in 1987, I was shocked that they didn't even have a mortgage department. So I worked with the mortgage department to get that up and running for Fifth Third Bank. Now, again, they were a very small bank, $7 billion compared to what they are today. But I did not actually work in that department, but I'd helped them get that up and running since I knew the mortgage business. So I stayed in retail there only about a year, and they tapped me to go into the commercial side of the business. So I was moved in, and actually I was the first female to move into the national lending division of Fifth Third. Now, this will go to show you, I want to give you an example how times have changed. When I first interviewed with the head of the commercial group and actually the president of Fifth Third Bank, again, at this time we were about $8 billion, they, and again, being the first female, one of the questions they asked me was, because this was 100% travel, one of the questions they actually asked was, now, do you think your husband will be okay with you not being home to make dinner every night? I can't make this up. And I'm not sure. I was very quick to say, you know, interesting question, but his dinner won't change because 90% of the time the guy eats cereal for dinner anyway. So, you know, and the rest is history. I moved into the national lending for 5 years. Never had to look at goals because I knew what my job was, and that was to travel and bring business in the bank. I was then given the opportunity in 1992, Fifth Third had just bought a small bank that was taken over by the RTC in 1992, September, and they were looking for, September of 91, they bought a failed bank from the RTC, and then they started looking at people at Fifth Third in the headquarters that would be able to take the position of president, CEO, and really grow the bank in Florida. And I raised my hand and interviewed and got the job, came down, checked out the market, and took the position April 3rd of 1992 was my first day Florida.
It's very difficult to interrupt Colleen once she gets going, and that's can you define CEO, president, in terms of, some CEOs and presidents really aren't CEOs and presidents, and some are, okay? In your case, okay, as far as the division in Southwest Florida, what was the definition of CEO and president?
That's really a great question, because many folks that will be hearing this will probably say, you know, big deal, it's a big bank, you were, market president or what have you. That was not the case at Fifth Third. The business model at Fifth Third was very different than every other bank at that time. The business model is this. When you become president and CEO of one of the affiliates, and that is a key word, because at that time, Fifth Third Bank had 11 affiliates. Each bank was separately chartered, separately organized, and separately regulated. So I dealt with, at that time, the OTS, the Office of Thrift Supervision, because we had bought a thrift. Later, in an acquisition, we converted to a state bank. But we were separately regulated. The FDIC would come down and examine us. The state would regulate us. And actually, the state on the trust side would regulate us. So we definitely were a separate entity, making our own decisions, setting our own rates, managing the entire business, meaning commercial, consumer side of the bank, the CFO in marketing is who reported to the president, whereas mm-hmm. other banks are very decentralized. And, I mean, centralized. We were definitely decentralized. The only advantage I had being part of a very large institution was I did not have to raise capital every time I needed it, which was very often because we grew the bank so quickly.
That's amazing because not just in banking, but that's a very highly unusual situation across business, period, to actually be a division, well, not a division head, but a CEO with P&L responsibilities, government, international personalities, and, you know, the FDIC came to you and not to George Schaefer, the president of the company, right?
Right.
So that's
exactly.
Even...
I sat on the Florida Bankers Board of Directors, and we had our own P&L, and I think, you know, that's what makes everybody accountable. And Richard, you're a pro at this, but I was responsible for the P&L. I was responsible for the earnings. So my daily decisions, if I was going to add staff, if I was going to add a new product, if I was going to add a new line of business, I had to make a decision financially that it was a good decision both for our organization and, of course, for the bottom line that I could recoup, you know, if it was a new product, for example, or a new line of business. When I brought in public, we had public funds. We didn't have that when I first came down there.
You had what?
An analysis.
You had what kind of,
person,
I'm sorry, I didn't hear what kind of funds you had.
Pardon?
What kind of funds did you have?
Public funds.
Oh, public funds.
It's a officer that would call on municipalities, city, county, states, and nonprofits and to do financing like bond issues for public financing and those kinds of things. So we got to the point, we knew that could be a great line of business for us, but it wasn't until about year 7 that we brought on that new line of business.
And whose idea was that?
Mine, and I'll tell you how that happened. A gentleman came down from Cincinnati. His parents lived down this way, and he wanted to apply, which he was applying for. He had a background in government. And he was applying for the CFO of the city of Naples. And he touched base with me because, of course, if he came from Cincinnati, they would say, hey, go see Colleen. She might be able to help you or what have you. So we met, and he said, I said, keep me posted on what happens with you. And he called and said he was down to the final three but did not get that position. So that night, true story, I woke up at 2 in the morning and said, oh, my God, what am I, chopped liver? I could take someone who's been on the other side of the desk, put him on the bank side of the desk. He speaks the language of these folks. And not only that, but he has the experience on the finance side. So it was a marriage made in heaven. He came and actually did all his training at one of our other affiliates who already had that line of business. He came down, and that line of business was profitable within 2 months.
It's called connecting the dots.
Yes.
Without with no ironclad things around the box, thinking out of the box. And it's called instinct, right? And, you know, what I'd like to say at this point, I was going to call you an entrepreneur, but from what you've described so far, it's so far more than an entrepreneur who's responsible for the P&L of a division, operations, and stuff like that. In this case, I don't know what to name it because it's really... it's way above an entrepreneur. I guess the only thing they had a say over is whether they were happy with you. And we all know from being down there that Colleen proceeded to kick the butt off of every other bank in the area. And that included SunTrust, that included Bank of America, that included BB&T, whether they were there or not. I mean, she massacred them, okay? And we're going to get into how she did that, okay? But before that, you're still there, right, Colleen?
Yes.
Okay,
sure,
good. Am. Okay. Because the computer just said blank. We're going to talk about you personally and professionally, okay? But we're going to start off personally with some questions because we want to know what made a Colleen Kovetko. Well, how did a Colleen Kovetko happen? So, because clearly Colleen Kovetko is the most unusual banker that I've met, and I've dealt with at least 10 banks, and her results demonstrate that too. I doubt, you know, when you start off with a $1 million bank and turn it into a $1 billion bank, in how long?
In 10 years.
That's ridiculous in that population base, okay? That's a ridiculous achievement. In that population, just an absolute ridiculous. And so we're going to really want to know how you did it. Now, remember, this will only go within the college. None of your competitors, former competitors will know. Tell me about your childhood and your peer groups. Who did you used to hang out with when you were a kid? What kind of peer group?
Well, it's, you know, Richard and... I just did an article for a magazine down here, and of course this came up, and I will tell you, I came from an unbelievable family and had an unbelievable childhood. I'm very blessed that I had, you know, both parents through, well, my dad just passed away 4 years ago, so, you know, we grew up in a two-parent family. My dad, as I said, was in the finance business, but I think it goes back to really your core values and your imprinting, how you were brought up. And I won't say they weren't strict, because it certainly they were, but it was, you know, it was in the 60s and 70s. Actually, I graduated from high school in 73, so I was really born in 54. But my upbringing, as far back as I can remember, which I think was second grade, you know, our parents really gave us the time and attention, and we grew up where everybody sat at the kitchen table every single night at 5:30, and we heard about, you know, how hard, you know, my dad worked, my mom didn't work at that time, but just, you know, being friendly and accepting people who they are.
What did your dad do?
Pardon?
What did your dad do?
He actually worked for a finance company, and believe it or not...
Oh, that's right.
He supervised several offices, but he was also the one that went and collected from families, which was very difficult for him. And those stories I remember more than anything, where, you know, he just kept working with people saying, you know, I know you can pay, I know you can give me $20 this week, and whatever. Did he have to go to the front door and collect? Sometimes, yes. But it was very difficult for him because his values, his personality, he wanted to help people. You know,
not exactly the
environment today.
Not exactly like the collectors from Pakistan who call you up, right?
No. So, you know, we grew up in a loving family, and when I started to work, my dad got me my first job in a bank when I was 16, because he knew the branch manager and gave me the first opportunity at banking, which, again, I never looked back. So I'm the only one from my family that actually went into finance, but my brother's a salesman. My two sisters are both in the medical industry. One opens new offices for doctors. The other one is an office manager for a doctor who was in the concierge business back in Cleveland.
So you came from an environment where achievement was encouraged and actually as an example. I mean, there was examples, but of achievement, and it sounds like you had kind of an Ozzie and Harriet, you know, kind of thing at 5:30. What I was asking you was your child, and you jumped questions, which is what Colleen does. She goes to the beef. Your childhood peers, who were your friends and why? What group did you fit in? Were you in the popular group, or were you separated out on your own, or with just a few friends, because you didn't quite relate to the cheerleaders or whatever. Explain that. Explain your childhood peer.
You'll be in shock. I was. My dad said many times, "You should have been a boy," because I love team sports. I actually played football in high school. We had a girls' team; it was a flag football, but it was fun. I played, softball. I was on a bowling league. I did all those team sports, and then in high school, I was definitely, that's when we had basically the two groups, which was, the Most School Spirit, and then you had the Greasers. Again, remember that was in the early 70s.
Oh, the Greasers.
I was with the Boosters. I was the class treasurer. I was voted Most School Spirit. So I was in the...
Well, that's not really surprising. One of the other interviews, was Donna Riley, who hung out with the boys. She did not hang out with the girls. Sports were her thing, and frankly, she used to run over the other kids' bikes, and she didn't see herself as a girl as an early, in her early childhood, and they didn't see her as a girl. Okay, and sports is a theme that seems to keep coming up. With entrepreneurs and successful entrepreneurs and entrepreneurs. So your peers were related to either sports or the school spirit crowd. Is that correct?
Right.
Okay. And, of course, you were just after the revolution crowd, which was me. Okay?
Right.
And what was your... And how did you relate to your peers? Was it about, planning on competition and doing planning on sports activities together, or the Boosters thing? It sounds like it was more, here's our goal, let's do it together, but I don't want to put words in your mouth.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I was more of a, I liked being part of a team, but I also probably too often tried to take charge.
Gee, I'm surprised. I'm so shocked.
And, being involved in Boosters and starting that's when jacket clubs were hot. Started a jacket club of a bunch of gals, and I've done that my whole life, really.
Let's go into taking
organizations I'm involved in.
Let's go into taking charge. Let's go into the psychological background of taking charge. I think I know the reason for that is, but what is your reason for wanting to take charge?
I'm just a person that I like to take charge, and actually it's all about really leadership, because I like to make a difference. And if it's involved with things like even when I was a kid, but even more importantly today, I when I get involved in a charity, an organization, and you could say 25, 30 years ago, I like to be part of growth. You know, if I was part of a bank today that they wanted to shrink and sell, that would not work for me. Because
right.
I don't want to do that. I
right.
want to grow something. I want to see the benefits of your work, so to speak.
Well, there's one reason
you're in charge of, you know, a mall and, you know, the NCA chairman of this event or chairman of that. I want to get in, make a difference, and I'm not one of these that sits on anything for more than one term, possibly two if it's only a two-year term, but I want to get in, I want to make a difference with that organization, and I want to get out and let somebody else take it to the next level. So I just like making a difference with everything I do, everything I touch.
But there's one thing you're missing. You're being a little humble here, and that is, don't you think you want to take charge because you know you're going to make a difference? You know that that's your proper role?
I think I do now. Early on, I didn't realize that, but as you get older and take on more really difficult tasks, you just know you have it in you. I mean, I never, ever, ever looked at my goals. I can tell you that. I just never did. Even when I went into the national division at Fifth Third, quarterly we had to report back to our supervisor where we stood. And I was only in the job 2 months. And, you know, the first 2 months I didn't reach the goal that they gave me. And I said, well, that'll never happen again. And I just worked a whole heck of a lot harder, made a lot more calls. I didn't track it through the next quarter, but I knew I was going to need it. And I just never looked back. So I know in my head what I need to do every single day. And I put that plan to work every single day. For example, the bank I'm currently with now is a small community bank. Will be the only community bank in Naples very soon.
Which is very sad. Which is very sad, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. It is very sad because it's sad for the industry, but, you know.
But knowing Colleen, she'll have community banks all over the state, but that's all right.
Well, I got to tell you, because you will enjoy this saying, our former chairman at Fifth Third about 20 years ago, 24 years ago, said one thing that I kind of keep in the back of my mind. I don't tell too many people, but I keep this in the back of my mind. And he said, when the competition is drowning, stick a hose down their throat.
That sounds like me, Colleen. You're not competitive at all, are you, Colleen? Okay.
Right. But with that happening in my market, I get excited about that, not from an industry. I know it's not great for the industry, but it's great for my bank to take advantage of that. And I think that's what you have to do in business. I know you did that. I know many other people that did that. If you look at FedEx, there's a company in Malcolm Baldrige did the same thing. They took the opportunity when the competition was either drowning or wasn't even in existence yet, and they took that and said, we're going to make a viable business out of that. And I do the same thing, you know.
Winning gives you a real kick, doesn't it?
It does.
And it's,
And you don't do that alone. You don't win alone. It takes an entire team, and I get that too. But you've got to make sure you have the right people on the bus, all heading in the right direction. I've had to make a lot of tough decisions in this position as well, and even at Fifth Third, as you know, things were getting worse, and we had to cut staff. Or when you cut, you have to say, okay, is this person really the person you need in that position? Is that their skill set, or is it something else? I mean, you have to constantly look at that.
I think one of the interesting things here is I've had all these questions, and you've answered them before I asked them. Okay? Okay. That's very interesting. We were going to your parents, and did they encourage free thinking and creativity, which I already know the answer. What was your here in every other interview, I've had to go over each one of these questions. You've already answered them. The only one you might not have answered, although the sticking the hose down a person's throat is a good one. I love that. Was there one person of great influence in your life, if you had to say?
I actually have to say two. One, you know, my parents, both of them. My mom was the disciplinarian, but my dad was a true role model from a business perspective.
Yeah.
And our former chairman at Fifth Third Bank, he was the epitome of a role model. He remembered the real little details on individuals, on families, on customers, on your sales. He was really instrumental in my success and just a wonderful role model. I've had many, though, and I continue to have mentors today. I don't think you ever outgrow that, but what does happen is you now flip that and you say, I need to mentor the people coming up behind me. I need to make sure that I'm making them successful. I want them on a winning team. And so we work as a team to do it together. And so at some point in your life, you look for the mentors, but then you become one because people are watching you, what you do, what you say, how you build a business. And I'm at the point of, you know, making sure I have the right team, and the ones that are getting on the bus early, I know are going to be very successful.
Well, we're going to go into that. Let's go to your landing in Naples, Florida, and here you are, and you look around, and you say, give me some examples to illustrate the challenge you faced in starting Fifth Third. Did you call it Fifth Third Southwest Florida or Fifth Third Florida?
Florida. Fifth Third Bank, Florida.
Okay. And so what was the challenge you faced in starting that business? Because a $1 million business is not a business at all in banking, right?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
It's like a $50,000 business. It's like a $50,000 tobacco store, right? Okay,
yeah.
So you see, you've got a startup, and so tell us the challenge you faced.
Well, this will be the rest of the story because when I had the opportunity to come down and check out Naples, in particular, I came out, and as you know, in your business and in my business, competition better know what your competition is doing. So the first thing I did was, even before I had the job, before I accepted, I came down just to look at Naples, see if I wanted to be here and have, you know, move our family here. And I went into five different banks, and this is a life lesson for everyone. I went into five different banks, and again, I was very young. I was 36 at the time. I had shorts and a T-shirt on.
Yeah.
But I wanted to see how my competition treated me. I wanted to know what products they had. I wanted to see what their sales focus was. And I walked into five different banks, some small, some large. And I walked up to the brochure rack. I'm reading the brochure. I'm looking around. Not one person, Richard, not one at small bank and large bank came up to me and said, can I help you? So my next call was to my husband, and I said, hun, I got to tell you, I'm going to take the job if they offer it. And he goes, really? And I said, let me tell you something. I couldn't screw this up if I tried. No one did service down here. Not one person asked if they could help me. There was nothing. And I said, you know what? I have to bring my Midwest work ethic, my values, my customer service. I am going to bring that to Naples, and I am going to make this bank successful down here. I'm going to find a team to get it done because there's so much opportunity, I can taste it.
Right.
And the rest is history. You know, we opened with really three people, and we grew that bank and kept, we were actually in a condo, second floor. I mean, I'd have customers come in and say, the good news is you're not on wheels. you can't at least drive away with my money. My challenge was, one of my biggest challenges was, what the heck is a Fifth Third?
Right.
Are they one and two thirds bank?
It's a weird name.
They are.
It's a very tough branding name. I mean, other than it being memorable, okay? You know, it just doesn't mean anything. I know what it means. It means, you know, on the corner of 5th and 3rd in Cincinnati, but nobody else knows what it means, okay? And it's got no image. It's a very difficult name to work with, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know, the first year of advertising, and that was part of it. Now, the good news is 42% of the population in Naples is from the Midwest.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that helped.
You know, that was a good thing for me because people from Ohio, Indiana, and Michigan, or Kentucky, had at least heard of us. But my first year of advertising, my ad was, what is a Fifth Third? So I explained that in the ads. And then, you know, I got involved in 17 different organizations. I had to spread the word. And when I hired a new employee, I gave him my list and said, hey, do any of these, you know, interest you? And I got our employees involved in the community, because if you're involved in the community as a banker, the community will return the favor. And so that is really how we built the bank, is to be involved, be part of the community. And I knew when I had made an impact, the day someone called and told me that, they said, now, I said, I was leaving for Cincinnati, something like that. And this customer said, oh, is there a branch in Cincinnati? then I knew what we were doing down in Naples, that we had actually made it to the big time, because they did not even know we were a bank out of Cincinnati. They thought we were a local bank.
Did you tell the chairman that?
Yes, actually, and then that same year we were given an award, and you remember Chip Reeves.
Oh, yeah.
We were very young.
Yeah.
Chip and I were at a chamber meeting, the Naples Chamber of Commerce, and we received the Large Business Award, and we looked at each other and went, large?
Yeah.
I mean, we were a small, small bank at that time.
Right. But perception is reality.
Perception.
So you probably monikered yourself as, excuse me, five times the service and three times the results. That might have been a good moniker. When problems arose, okay, how did your management team or you resolve them?
Well, 99% of the time, I will say, we sat down as a team and kind of went through the problem with the solution behind it, and really identified, it didn't matter if it was, you know, on a customer related, if it was product, if it was people, whatever it was, we really sat down every single week and walked through the issues. And, you know, if it was a people problem, we were all on the same page 99% of the time. If someone wasn't on the team, it was best to say goodbye to them and you know, hello to someone else. But if regardless of what it was, we really worked as a team for that solution. I was very close to my CFO. That was my right-hand person, and she was very logical, very structured. She was great at what she did. She knew the numbers, and she also knew, you know, the assets I brought to the, or the skill set I brought to the bank, and it wasn't the numbers. It was her I relied on, and I was to be out getting the business and rallying the troops and making sure our team was motivated to do the very best. So, you know, I...
So you gave, you made, you gave her your own, her own little business, didn't you?
Yeah.
We've already answered this question because you're the first interviewee that keeps ahead of the questions, which is really making me upset. Okay. You know, and I bet the next question is, how have your experiences that you've had during your entire career influenced the way you run your own company? You don't have to answer that. You already have. When someone joined your company, how did you orient them as a member of your team?
Well, regardless of what position they were going to hold, regardless, we did have a formal orientation. And I presented at every single orientation throughout my whole 25 years at Fifth Third. And the 20 years down here, every single orientation I was there, I wanted to meet the people, I wanted to say hello, I wanted to make sure they knew my door was open. The other thing I would do, at least if it was a direct team member that was a little different, we would sit down and really talk about the business, strategize, and then, you know, set goals and then meet on a weekly basis. If it was a level down or a second level down, one thing I did rely on was my direct reports to share with me not just the areas of risk or the issues they might go, be going through, but I also, on a weekly basis, had what I called the war report. It was the weekly activity report. The first thing on that report was successes. Because I wanted to make sure I called people within the organization, even if it was a teller that, you know, saved the bank money by noticing a forged check or whatever it was. I wanted to make sure I was involved through the whole organization and not just at the top.
What I definitely noticed, okay, from tellers on up to assistant managers, I mean, you had how many banks there when I left there?
15.
But I mean,
about 215 people before the big acquisition.
But that included that big acquisition. So you ended up really 100 banks or so. And what I did notice is that even the tellers knew you and what you were. And, you know, oh, Colleen, yeah. I mean, you know, it was amazing and very unusual. But tell us how you motivated and rewarded people.
Well, motivation definitely comes within, and everyone's motivated in a very different way. And I tried to really, again, just calling them for some, you know, all the employees for different things they might be doing on a daily basis. And I always had, you know, little incentives with me, no matter where I went or what I did. Things like movie tickets or gift certificates or what have you. I sent at least 10 to 15 personal thank yous a week. Not to mention, I had two meetings with employees, one on their anniversary of being with the bank, and I'm still doing that as of today, but if their anniversary was in the month of July, I would send them a personal invitation, and we would have a group breakfast, and we would talk about, you know, how their job was going, what could we be doing better, what do they like about the bank? So a little bit of a roundtable kind of thing. And then, of course, on their birthday, send them a gift certificate and, you know, just happy birthday kind of thing. But to motivate people, we would have quarterly bank-wide meetings. Sometimes they were by conference call. But I think the way you motivate people is through communication. And I wanted to make sure the employees knew that there was transparency at our organization. It was not the political bullshit, let's say, many others went through at other organizations. I was very transparent. My employees from the top to the bottom knew what was happening with the organization, how they would impact different changes, and engage the employees in your daily business. Because if they're engaged, if they love what they do what they love, you really don't have many problems with an organization.
Right people,
and they're motivated.
Politics, I think you would agree, is the enemy of production.
Yes.
And
no question.
One of the interesting things is I received a week ago a card. I'm in the Smoky Mountains. I received a card from Colleen's new bank, Shamrock Bank, okay, announcing her existence, okay, and in her own personal font. And I noticed that it was the same font as like 10, 15 years ago. I couldn't figure it out. I said, I've never seen a font like this. Wait a minute. This is her font. And the reality is, how can I help her? Well, you know what? Why wouldn't I deposit money from here to there? What I used to do, the bank was so good. When I moved up here, I kept my account at Fifth Third. The banks up here didn't give me any better service, 1,000 miles away, than Fifth Third. So the only reason why I moved my account, honestly, was because I borrowed $4 million from somebody up here, okay? And you weren't able to do business in North Carolina in that kind of way. And you weren't able to finance land. Fifth Third was not here at that time. And
right.
Had Fifth Third been here, they would have been the bank I would have gone to. Of course, Colleen, I'm not sure when your transition was, but I wouldn't have gone to any other bank. So I went into new banks, and, frankly, they had some good functional stuff, but I mean, they weren't a business bank, and they didn't have the Fifth Third instinct, okay? And they weren't a business they weren't a smart business partner. In other words, what they weren't is they were telling you to develop one piece of land you knew damn well that you should be developing near the college and not out in the middle of nowhere, that in your stomach something was wrong in 2007, you better run and do your condos. But no, they just didn't have the savvy, okay, that Colleen had and her team about what to do next. They weren't a partner, okay? Now, they were nice and they were supportive, but those are just words. Okay, Colleen knew I knew how to run a food business, which is what she financed for me. So she didn't really have to get into that as so much. But in terms of strategic stuff, Colleen Kvetko and her bank could have helped me out a whole hell of a lot in 2007. And when we tried to transit into an energy company, Colleen Kvetko would have been behind that 100% because Richard had enough instinct to know that real estate was going to, not blow up to the tune that it did. He knew about Florida, but his instinct in 2006 to start an energy company would have been supported by Colleen Kvetko and Fifth Third Bank, and the results would have been major difference. Okay, but I remember, I don't know how you did it, but you always seemed to be a big bank, okay? And I don't remember how you got all these golf outings and forced me to go to these golf outings. And all of a sudden I was with, maybe 40 or 50 business people. And we went golfing, and it was a family type of thing, and we felt part of Fifth Third, okay? And people who weren't involved in Fifth Third yet got sucked in, okay? They got sucked in. We didn't get invited to anything like that by SunTrust. I don't know how you got me. Your bank got me. I just didn't walk in. Okay?
Right.
Because I didn't even know you were handling my receivable up in Macomb, Ohio. So you targeted me. Okay? You targeted me and went after me.
Yeah.
And I simply said, I want $1.5 million worth of a line of credit. I want 80% receivables and I want 50% of the inventory and throw in a couple $100,000 for fun. And it was an interesting situation because you had a vice president who was a little more tidy-whitey than you were, okay? And we played golf together, and he was resistant. And I did not want to go over his head to you, okay? So we played golf one day, and it was a 25-foot putt going two ways. And I said, if I sink this putt, you'll give me the loan, because he was very resistant. And I sank it, and the guy jumped up and down and said, I didn't tell you what interest it was. And eventually, I had to go to Colleen and say, Colleen, he's not going to give me the loan, okay? And Colleen believed in me even when I didn't believe in myself. And so they made good money on Cool Fruits. They got good interest. They got, at the end of it, there was seven figures in their bank. She just knew. She had beyond your professionalism is an instinct for who's going to perform and who's not. My teacher, Dr. Lam, has this instinct as well. He got me up speaking the other day, and he never even had a resume. And I said, why'd you do that? And he said, I have an instinct for performers. Talk about that, because... and maybe that comes out of sports and stuff, but talk about your instinct. Someone's walking into the bank with a concept, a business idea, or whatever. The role of your instinct in giving that person a loan or not.
Yeah, and I think you hit the nail on the head with a couple things. One, I think banking, and that's why I'm back to a community bank, is it's all about relationship banking. But it's also about, you know, the five C's, and character has always been number one with me. I know credit's important. I know cash flow's important. I know collateral's important. But to me, it's the character. And I think I read people pretty well. And part of it is my gut. It is an instinct. Now, if I had someone that, you know, that had terrible numbers, unfortunately, sometimes you just have to say no, and the quicker you say it, the better it is, because you can maintain that friendship. What we're doing now is when we say no, we're also consulting at the same time, but I think the banks aren't doing that right now. They're more consulting and saying, this is why we said no. Let's walk through, you know, the numbers, and let's give you advice that when you get to this, I want you to come back to our bank. But it really is relationship banking, and it's making sure you know who's paying your paycheck, and that's the customers.
Right.
And, you know, I've always believed in making sure the customer comes first, and that is making sure they feel engaged and they want to send customers our way, because that is the marketing team.
Well, would you define customers? Would you define customers? Okay. Would you define, there's two sets of customers, I think. What, in your, or more, what would you define customers for us?
Well, I would say, you know, you've got two different lines of business. One, commercial customers, and those are the ones, small business we're attacking. Small business, the commercial real estate non-owner occupied is having a very tough time right now. It's because the times we're in, the developers are having a tough time.
Right.
On the owner occupied, you know, real estate, we're still, I think we're one of the only banks doing that down our way. But again, any customer on the commercial side, again, small business.
Right.
And then on the other side, it's everything else. It's primarily the retail customer, but it's the individual that you have to make sure you engage them as well, that you do recognize that they're part of the bank, and we want them to send their friends, their neighbors, their doctor, their dentist. We ask people, if you're happy with the service, please send your friends. We need everybody out there marketing for the bank, and that's basically how I grew Fifth Third, and that's how I'm growing Shamrock Bank. Now, we're the smallest bank, literally the smallest bank in Collier County as of today, but perception is also, how the market perceives us. We have one office down on Fifth Avenue, which, Richard, you know, it's...
Oh, that's major. I didn't know that. That's
a wonderful location. It's the former chamber building. It's a billboard. But that's our only location. So how do you market to your North Naples customers or your customer base in the industrial parks to go down to Fifth Avenue? Well, you don't. You can market to them if you've got the services that will provide them the same thing they have with their current bank, but now it's going to be a much more tighter relationship because we're going to have to pick up your deposits for you.
Yeah, because there's no parking down there.
Yeah, and we do things like that, or remote capture. But I just moved the loan office, which was just in a small little office complex that no one could find us. I moved that to North Naples, right on 41.
Ah.
It's the...
Location.
Location. Now, even though it says Shamrock Bank of Florida Loan Center, people have been stopping in to open new accounts.
Nah.
So, it's using our current customer base, but also branding the bank. So... I want those customers too. I want remote customers that I'll pick up their deposits. I'll do what I need to do to get the business. One of the things that did drive my CFO crazy, and it's driving my new CFO crazy, is when I go into a customer and they say, I'd like to do this, this, and this. I'll give you a great example. Walked into a church. They have great deposits. It's someone I want to bank. However, their collection is, of course, on Sunday. They have volunteers count it. They need a coin counter to do that, a currency counter. And they go to the bank, which is very close to where they're at. They drive that deposit over to the bank. And so we don't do that right now. We don't have a bank down the street from them. However, when you're in the meeting, I say, okay, I can do that. Then I walk out and I look to the officer and I say, well, now we got to figure out how to do that.
Yeah.
There's a solution to it.
Right.
So we just secured all that business and we can do that.
I believe you went to the bank and had a counter yourself every Sunday and now you've got religion. This is a double question because you're facing this challenge. You've kind of bought this new bank. Okay, get your foot back in the door. It's been very frustrating for you to buy banks because of the FDIC and the regulations. The regulations are going to kill this country. We both agree on that, and we're going to go into that later. How do you select people to join your company? And in the new company you bought, you're facing challenges with the existing people, and it doesn't take you, it takes you a heartbeat to figure out. The other day I asked you, I said, how many people are going to stay there? And you said, of the 10 people in that bank, 2 people are going to stay there. And how long did it take you to make that decision? Okay, so how do you select people to join your company? And vice versa, how do you select people to leave?
That's probably the best question. And I think if you ask any CEO, they're going to say, if I would change anything over my career, I would have made the decision quicker. And people hold on to people because it becomes a relationship.
Right.
And you're affecting families, you're affecting individuals. But what I have to remember, Richard, is my job is to report and to make sure that I am enhancing shareholder value. And when you keep that at the top of your mind, you do have to make those tough decisions. That's the hardest part of any CEO's job. But you are absolutely right as far as being able to identify them quickly, because I don't even have to identify them. People fire themselves. I truly believe that.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you why. When prior to the announcement coming that I was going to be in the paper that I was taking over Shamrock Bank, I went and told the employees personally with an announcement with a couple of the directors. At that time, I took the opportunity to share my vision of the organization, what we were going to do, how we were going to get there, what my expectations were. And I think the more you share that, the better off you are. So I then took that to the next step, and I met with every single employee, and I said, I only had one question for them, Richard. I said, please describe the culture at this bank. And I got every answer you could imagine. And one of the answers all of them gave me was there was a major lack of communication. And so I knew, okay, I put that as priority number one. And so they helped me set my priorities. And I quickly, came to the conclusion. There were certain individuals for 4 years have been collecting a paycheck but not really adding the value of the organization. And they came to the conclusion just as I did, some quicker than others. But I think we're changing a lot. We're shaking things up. We're restructuring. We're making those tough decisions. And now people are saying, ooh, new sheriff in town. I really do have to step up my game. And I'll tell you, I can tell you exactly today who is going to make it in 6 months and who's not going to be there. But what I am doing, Richard, which I think is very important and critical to anyone's success as an organization, is you also have to give them, in my case, just coming in, I have to give them the opportunity to prove me wrong. I have to give them the opportunity to step it up and bring their skill set at 150% level to make this work. And those who don't, I mean, they've never had goals before, but they do now. And those who don't help the organization be successful, they already know who they are.
I've
been pleasantly surprised, and others I knew they would last about 3 months.
Well, you've changed. You've changed in 1 week. You've changed in 1 week from 10 to 2 to 6 to 4, which is amazing.
Right.
Somebody stepped up. Somebody stepped up, didn't they?
Yeah. I've got basically, I would say, 3 people today that really stepped up their game.
In a week. In a week. Okay.
Yeah.
That's how fast you move, okay? I'm going to tell you, that is the biggest failure of Richard Wirth. He is not good at hiring and firing, okay? Well, let's move on from that, but I'll tell you, that's a terrible weakness, and I'm learning from this interview. I knew it, but you have made me face it, okay? And the difference is, what I used to do is have such high gross margins or such a successful product that it would overcome this inferiority, okay? But it cost me over the years probably $1 billion, if you want to know the truth. And, when I hired somebody to be the president of Delicious, and he was a Harvard MBA and a CPA and a Quaker Oats brand manager, well, We had a $500 million bid on Keebler. The guy lost $5 million in the first 4 months. And Wasserstein Perella and the biggest M&A guy in Wall Street said, if you can't run a $100 million company, Richard, how are you going to run a $1 billion company? And unfortunately, I had to be in Long Island, okay? But I got some advice, and I didn't take it, okay? He was buying cookies for a buck, selling them for a buck and a quarter, and spending 50 cents selling them, okay? That's simple. And, but you are better at it than me, and there's no question about that. What I want to do now is ask you to, you've bought this company, Shamrock. I know you have long-term aggressive goals, okay? And even if they're less aggressive than if you were 40, okay, you'll find somebody to bring them up to that aggression, okay? I know you, okay? And so why don't you describe a typical day at Shamrock? It's a traditional bank, but it's a startup too at this point. So let's talk about a traditional day at Shamrock.
It is. It's a community bank, so that means, you know, we all wear five different hats. And that's the challenge. That's the real challenge, because we all have to do, you know, the administration piece with it, the sales piece with it, the operations piece. We have to have a little bit of everything. And one of the things I am so glad about is having the experience at a very large corporation, because I know what I want to get to and how to get there. And, you know, unfortunately, many of the individuals I have always been with small banks, so they think small.
What does that mean?
You know, you have to, well, again, going, especially from a customer's perspective, they go for the little customers instead of going for some larger customers where you can get just a small piece of their business, but it's your foot in the door. As you grow, the company grows, as you grow as a bank, you can provide more services to those companies. You just got to get your foot in the door.
Yeah. It's like that $5 million company coming in and seeing a representative who really doesn't know how to play a role of a bank to a $5 million company, right?
Right, yeah. So, I mean, you know, you have to... you have to do it all. I mean, I'm my own secretary, and honestly, I should have fired myself by now because I'm not my secretary. But I know also I have to do it for a while until we get to that point where I can bring someone on part-time. Compliance is a real problem in the banking structure. The regulatory environment is challenging, and the regulations...
I think you wanted to say pathetic.
Yeah, it is pathetic. So what I'm doing there, though, and it's a perfect example of how you take people's talent and move them into what they should be doing, and they do it very well. My current CFO is also the chief operating officer, so she does operations. Well, the first time I sat down with her and told her I'm having a challenge with her, I'm not getting what I need from a financial perspective, and I just need to know how she wants me to communicate, because apparently I'm doing something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
She leaned back, and she puts her hand on her chest, and she said, I am not a CFO. I love operations. And she is absolutely right, but it was a red flag, you know, it's like
right.
The light bulb went on. She was put in that job as a CFO because at the time when they were organized in 07, they didn't have one, and she could probably do that job for a year. Well, it's 4 years later, and it's much more, it's a lot more detailed, and it's a lot more strategy these days. She just doesn't have that skill set. So I am splitting that position. She's going to move into total compliance and operations, which she will do very well. And I'm looking for a CFO to take that position over. Now, that also means more money. So, you know, I've got to make sure I have the right lenders out there bringing in the income.
Right.
But I'm also willing to raise my hand. I think that's the other life lesson you learn early on, that, you know what, Rome wasn't built in a day, but it wasn't built by one person either.
Yeah.
You've got to be able to raise your hand and ask for help. Ever since I came to this small bank, I've gotten a lot of contacts in small banks, and I can call them at any time, and they give me whatever I need. If it's a job description, if it's how they manage their portfolio, if it's how they price things, they're very open and willing to help. So I raised my hand and got some consultants in to really peel back the onion when it comes to people, process, technology, alignment, and flow of a bank, because I don't have the small bank experience. I know, my gut tells me I have a lot of money that could be found if I just consolidate things and realign things. So I have a consultant in now looking at that, and they've already found over $200,000 that's going to hit the bottom line.
Did you want to send it up here?
No, I've got a lot of retained earnings to, there's a lot of capital to put back into retained earnings.
How do you keep up with current events in your industry? Current events in your industry, or as a businessman in general, business person?
Well, we're lucky. We're very lucky that we have the resources from an industry perspective through the Florida Bankers Association, through the FDIC website. So I do get the ABA newsletters. I get several emails daily that I look at. I, you know, make sure that I'm up to speed on the compliance piece. And again, all my bank friends, you've got to have an unbelievable network in the banking environment to stay in on top of those things.
Yeah, they're not making it easy for you. Let me ask you this question here: What kind of a formal, and unfortunately, I think this interview is not about banking. That's how good it is. Okay, it's not just about banking; it's about how to do business. But I'm going to ask you this question anyways, about the formal education and additional specialized training that you would recommend that a person should acquire to enter into a profession like yours, or maybe you might extend that into a profession period.
Yeah, I think any profession, you know, and I even tell my nieces and nephews when they go to school to take any and all businesses, and a major in business is even better. Because really, that's something you can transfer those skills and that knowledge to anything. You know, business is going to cover a lot of things. It's going to cover finance. It's going to cover marketing. It's going to cover sales. It's going to cover leadership, management as a whole. So, you know, I would recommend any business courses. And then you say, okay, I've got that as my background. Now, what industry do I like? How do I want to take that skill set of knowing about business into, you know, the banking industry, the manufacturing industry, whatever that media industry, whatever that might be, is to translate that skill set into an industry. And then whatever industry you pick, enhance that with specific courses, specific, you know, it doesn't matter if it's seminars or college education, college courses or masters, then how do you take that to the next level depending on what business you want to go into?
But you went to college, right?
Yes.
What was your major?
College of Mount St. Joe, business.
Business, okay. So,
yeah.
All right. Now, I'm going to ask you, I've got this whole list that I'm going to send you. And it's going to say, you know, this is extremely important, very important, not so important, not important at all. But if you had to pick five things that are crucial to the success of a business, or three things, pick them.
Okay. Okay. Now?
Yep.
Okay. First and foremost, leadership. I think providing the right leadership for the organization, and that's really critical, because your employees are going to, they'll follow a true leader, and they'll want to work very hard for that leader. And that's half the, you know, that's half the battle in any organization. The other thing I would say, be very attuned and have knowledge of financials. You have to understand how to run your business and what makes your business, you know, profitable as soon as possible.
So you would say financial controls and reporting, and the essence of making a profit. What your fixed costs are, and variable costs and stuff like that.
Right, because if you're out making widgets and they cost you a dollar, but your sales team is selling them at $110,
right,
you got to figure out you're losing money hand over fist.
Right.
So I say financials and accounting information is always good. At least you don't have to be able to put the financials together, but you have to understand revenues versus your expenses and what percentages and all those metrics that are part of a financial statement.
And you have to, go ahead.
Top three, leadership, finance, and then the third one is sales. I think you may not be a good salesperson, but you better know how to find the sales manager and what it takes to sell your product or your service, whatever that might be. So I think sales is critical.
Yeah. You've got to close.
You got to close it. And, you know, I've seen a lot of people who are really good in their industry, but they couldn't sell a thing if they tried. And that's okay if you know your business, but you should also know that you need to complement, the company needs a sales force or a sales manager. Everybody sells something, even if it is a service.
Right.
It's a service, a widget, you sell something.
Right.
You've got to have sales for a business to be successful.
Right. Now, you've gone over so many of the things on this list. The one thing I didn't ask you, but I know you'll answer it. What's more important, working in your business or working on your business?
Oh, well, we know it's on your business. That's okay. Why those are the three most important things. You've got to work on your business every single day.
Okay.
And right now, I tell people, it's like eating an elephant for me today, but if I take one bite at a time, it'll all get done. But you have to look for those things that you need to do immediately, and you have to be able to say every single day, I made a little bit of progress. That's working on your business, not in your business. And most people that work on their business, Richard, you and I both know, that's what they're motivated on. You know, that's what motivates them, not picking up the paycheck.
Right.
It's never about the money. Very seldom about the money.
Yeah. You know so much that things like on my list is retention of customers is when you retain a customer, it's twice as profitable as getting a new one, right?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, we're going through that right now because this little bank, 90% of their customers only had one service.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, how can you...
What an opportunity.
...to be able... Right. Oh, my God, huge. Huge. Our goal is to have three per customer, and now everyone knows that. Everybody was aware of it, and we're all working towards that together. So, you know, that's how you build an organization. That's how you work on the business, not in the business.
I don't know how long we've been, but you've the interview's awesome. Normally, I would read these things to somebody, but I think we've been over so many of them, and we'd be redundant. So I'm going to send you them to fill out, The interview was just fabulous. I mean, I don't care who knows it. I think that let me shut this thing, stop recording here.